city in happier times, as mentioned before. Reverg is a fantastic speaker, and I, even 8 years, I guess 7 years after I left Yeshiva, I'm still zocha to have a connection with Reverg, and I still consider him my Rebbe. And he's also very open to Ksharim with anyone he meets. So if you have any questions afterwards, I'll give you his email. He'd be more than happy to be in touch. He's a fantastic role model of mine, and I would not be where I am right now if not for the guidance of Reverg when I was in the Yeshiva.
A little strange for me. I've been in Israel now for 9 years. And in 9 years, I've never felt like I was misplaced. I always felt right to be here. Except for one day a year. It never felt right to be here on Tisha B'Av. Back in America, I used to run to Esh Kodesh in Woodmere to sit near the Rebbe so I could hear what Rav Weinberger was going to say at night and during the day. And every year, Rav Weinberger started off Tisha B'Av with the same repetition of two words over and over again. Every year, he would say, Nach Tisha B'Av, Nach Tisha B'Av, again Tisha B'Av, again Tisha B'Av. And that Nach Tisha B'Av, it became part of my year. It was the beginning. It was that's how you began Tisha B'Av, Nach Tisha B'Av. When the Rebbe said Nach Tisha B'Av, then Tisha B'Av began. When the Rebbe said Nach Tisha B'Av, you felt the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And I came to Eretz Yisrael, and it was the craziest thing. Nobody said Nach Tisha B'Av. I've not really started Tisha B'Av in 9 years. In 9 years, I always feel like I should be back in America, because if I don't hear the Rebbe say Nach Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av didn't start. Until tonight. I never heard anyone say the word Yerushalayim like I heard Rav Weinberger say the word Yerushalayim. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to hear him. Most people, when they say Yerushalayim, they say Yerushalayim. When Rav Weinberger said Yerushalayim, he had like such longing, such gaguim for Yerushalayim. Say Yerushalayim. You ever hear him say Yerushalayim? And I feel like now, sitting on the porch, overlooking Yerushalayim, I feel like I'm in Yerushalayim. I feel like the bridge has been gapped between Nach Tisha B'Av and right now. I imagine that if it was nearly 2,000 years ago, tomorrow afternoon, we would have been sitting on this porch, looking at the flames coming up from Har HaBayis, and we wouldn't have known what to do with ourselves. Kaviyachal, like when I was in America for 9/11. And everyone was running up to the roof of my yeshiva to go see the skyline, to go see the smoke in the skyline. That's what would have been for us. And now we're here 2,000 years later, and we don't see the smoke, but there's this deep connection that we still have to Shalayim, to Beis HaMikdash, to Har HaBayis. I couldn't have said it any better than Avi said it before. We're holding now, it used to be that it was difficult. It used to be that it was difficult to try to access some of the pain of what Churban HaBayis means. Today we have very little difficulty. Av 5777. The state of Israel is trying to convince a bunch of Muslims to go daven on Har HaBayis. Is that not the most painful thing in the world? It's not a difficult thing to access. That we go, yes, Baruch Hashem, that we go to the Kotel. But we have a wall. That's what we have. We have a wall. And we look up to the left a little bit. We look up to the left and we see our cousins parading around over there, that a Jew can't go to Davin on Har HaBayis today. We say, Ki Beis Tefillah L'chol La'am. It's going to be my house, a house of prayer for everybody in the world. They say, you can't be here. So we're here, but we're not here. We're sitting on the roof, we're overlooking Yerushalayim, but it's Nach Tisha B'Av. It's Nach Tisha B'Av. We're not here yet. There's a fascinating halacha that tomorrow afternoon we begin to get up from the Avelos of Tisha B'Av. We begin. We sit on normal chairs. We put the paroiches back on the Aron Kodesh. We start to be making the food for the breaking of the fast. There's even a minig to start washing your floors to herald the coming of Mashiach. And yet the Gemara tells us, the Yerushalmi tells us, that really the burning of the Beis HaMikdash started tomorrow. Really, it started tomorrow. And it went all the way to the 10th. Which is why we don't eat meat tomorrow night. Which is why we wait. Because it's not really 100% over. But the question is, the obvious question. How could it be that in the time of the ultimate destruction is the time that the fast begins to diminish? Imagine if it was 2,000 years ago. And it's tomorrow afternoon. And somebody comes and they say to you, come to the roof, run to the roof. You're not going to believe it. It's actually happening. And you saw the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. You were watching it with your own eyes. Is it possible that we could start in that moment to start to sponge the floors, to herald the coming of Mashiach, to put the paroiches back onto the Aron Kodesh, to start to prepare a suda? Who could eat? Who could even think of eating? And for us, this is the time that we begin to diminish the time. It's a very strange thing. All the Ma'amari Chazal keep talking about Mashiach was born on Tisha B'Av. Eicha ends Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha V'Nashuva Chadesh Yameinu Kekadem. So we always look at Tisha B'Av in a certain sense as a fast day, a day of tzar, a day of brokenness. And when you actually look at the Ma'amari Chazal, it doesn't seem to have that quality. It seems to have some sort of redemptive quality to it. In fact, we don't say Tachnun tomorrow. Because it's called the Moed. We don't say Tachnun like a Chosun or a Kala on the day of their Chosun. We don't say Tachnun like a father on the day of his Bris Milah. That's tomorrow. This is an incredible paradox, one that requires us to understand something on a very deep level. I think we make a terrible mistake. We look at Tisha B'Av in a vacuum, as a 25-hour period. But the truth is that perhaps we need to look at Tisha B'Av as the fulcrum between Shabbos Chazon and Shabbos Nachman. A journey, beginning with the 3 weeks, getting more intense with the 9 days, Shabbos Chazon, and now on Tisha B'Av we start to move into a new segment of this month called Shabbos Nachman. Shabbos Chazon, Chazon means vision. But vision is a word that leaves us a little empty. Perhaps a better word would be imagination. Like in davening, we have a chazan. A chazan is somebody who leads us in a collective imagination. That's why the word palel comes from the lashon of imagination. Yaakov said to Yosef when he saw him so many years later in Mitzrayim, Lo palalti, I was never palal that I would see your face again. What does palal mean? Palal means to imagine. I never imagined. I never thought that this could be a possibility. This is not what came up for me when I was thinking in the world of what's going on in my life. I never imagined that there would be a reunion of Yosef HaTzadik and Yaakov Avinu. So Chazon means so much more than just to see. Chazon means to dream. And Chevra, Our dreams are so pathetic. We dream in such small terms. We don't dream for redemption in the global sense of the entire world coming to recognize David Machas Mashiach, V'haya Bayam O Yi Hashem Echad U'Shmai Echad. We dream that a parking lot won't be open on Shabbos, that they'll be a little less full of Shabbos. We don't see Jews for what they truly are, for what they could be. Instead, we focus on the negatives. He's from this ism, he's from that ism, he's Dati Lumi, she's Haredi, he's Mizrahi, she's Hasidish. Sometimes I feel like I've never met a Jew in my entire life. Our vision, our imagination, our eyes are so skewed. V'sechezena einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion b'rachanu. We daven that the Rebbeinu Shalom should return our eyes to be able to see once again real redemption, to be able to look and to see beauty in another person. I once heard from Weinberger that he said, we're like a child who recently lost a parent, like a 7-year-old kid who lost a parent. There's nothing more heart-wrenching in the entire world than seeing a child say Kaddish for his parents. You know why? Because he has no idea what he lost. He's 7 years old. He's 8 years old. He has no chazon. He has no vision. He has no dream. He can't imagine how his life was just altered. My shver passed away when my wife was 13 years old. I think her younger brother was 6. People still tell me what it was like to watch him say Kaddish. And today, by family get-togethers, when everyone's reminiscing about their father, he says, at least you have a father to reminisce about. I don't even know what I miss. So Shabbos Chazon is a Shabbos of trying to figure out what in the world is going on over here, to recalibrate our eyesight. And Shabbos Nachamu is not only a Shabbos of consolation, but actually the word Nachamu also means reconsideration. Like by the Chet HaEgel, where the Rebbeinu Shalom was Vayinachim, he reconsidered. He reconsidered. By the time we arrive at Shabbos Nachamu, the destination, in just a couple of days from now, we have to already be at a place where we see the world so differently. Where when we look at another Jew, we don't see what they wear. We don't see even how they behave. All we see is a sister or a brother. We already have to be there in just a couple of days from now. And the question is, how do we get to that place? And perhaps the answer to that question is Tisha B'Av. Perhaps the answer to that question is the paradox of coming up from Avelus in the middle of destruction. I want to read to you I'm a Gentile poet. He's one of my favorite poets in the entire world. And he talks about a concept called longing. And when I was reading this poetry, I thought to myself, maybe Avelus doesn't mean mourning. Maybe we've been taught the chitzonius of Tisha B'Av. We haven't accessed the essence, the pnimius of Tisha B'Av. Maybe on the outside Tisha B'Av is about mourning, but maybe on the inside it's about longing. And listen to this sentence. In longing we move and are moving from a known but abstracted elsewhere to a beautiful, about to be reached someone, something or somewhere we want to call our own. Maybe Tisha B'Av, we have feelings of Avelus because we long so deeply to move from where we are to where we want to be, to once again call the Rebbeinu Shalom our own. Like a wife who feels so distant from her husband because getting caught up in the vicissitudes of everyday life, they stopped paying attention to each other. But on the inside, when she's sitting and crying, in her room, and the husband doesn't even know that she's crying because he's out wherever he is. And she's crying because she misses her husband. So she's mourning in a sense, but in a deeper sense, she's longing for the return of someone and something and somewhere. That her house should once again be a house that's filled with love. That her marriage should be filled with love. That she can look at her husband, that her husband can look at her and say, we've returned to each other. That there's been redemption in our marriage. Maybe that's what Tisha B'Av is really about. Maybe that's why Rav Akiva was able to laugh when everybody else is crying. Because when everybody sees destruction and they see a fox coming out of the mikdash, so Rav Akiva sees in that destruction the longing, the yearning to return. Maybe that's why Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. Because in the most destructive moment, we reconfigure. We have a nechama, so to speak. And we realize that in ourselves, as we're watching everything that's going on, how much we dearly, dearly want the Rebbeinu Shalom to return to us. Hashiveinu Hashem Eilecha v'nashuva. Chadesh Yameinu kikedem. Return, return. We don't want this anymore. It's broken, it's empty, it's beautiful. But it's not enough. We're not satisfied. Lubavitcher Rebbe says that the word gola and the word geula is only missing the aleph, which is the alufo shel olam, the Rebbeinu Shalom. That's the only thing that's missing. A return to Eretz Yisrael we have in the process of an unbelievable kibbutz galios, unprecedented in history. But it's not enough because Ayeka, where's the Rebbeinu Shalom? We have not yet returned. We don't yet feel His love. I read for the first time that there was a minig in Klal Yisrael to bury the kinos after Tisha B'Av. That's why we have flimsy paper kinos. We don't want to invest too much money in our kinos. Because we used to bury them, because we knew this was the last year. We knew. There is no Nach Tisha B'Av. That's the hope. That's the hope that a Jew lives with. That's why the Navi calls us Asiri Tikva. We are prisoners of hope. With your permission, I want to read to you an article. I don't know this person, but I did reach out to him and ask him, Rishus, to read to you this article tonight. I read it a couple of days ago and I couldn't stop crying as I was reading it. The day before Tisha B'Av, 3 years ago, I ate the egg and ashes prescribed as the meal before the fast begins. Taking my last bite of sliced white bread on the eve of the darkest date in Jewish history, as I sat on a milk crate and gazed into a field and its tree-lined background, I began to cry. I wasn't only crying because of Tisha B'Av, but also for myself. I knew something was wrong. For weeks, while I'd been teaching at an Orthodox Jewish summer camp in upstate New York, I'd been waking up in bed sheets dampened by sweat, despite sleeping in air conditioning. My exhaustion and the lumps in my chest and throat had grown so rapidly that even in my bed I could find no rest. Before settling upstate for the summer, I had gone to see a dermatologist to deal with insatiable itch throughout my body. Like a fire spreading, it gave no warning, no sign of rash. A prescription for an ointment to soothe my skin was filled but never used. And now, weeks later, I was getting worse. The next morning on Tisha B'Av, I read Eicha, Lamentations, at camp. It was the first time I'd read it publicly. Assigned the fifth chapter, I came across verses that left me trembling, just as I did when I tried to sleep, shuddering from a cold that wasn't there. The fifth and final chapter of Lamentations is different from the previous four. It is the only one not arranged alphabetically, symbolizing the chaotic order and misalignment I felt going on within me. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to foreigners, it reads, much like my own body. Upon our necks we are pursued, we toil and we find no rest, much like the protrusion in my throat. After reading my chapter for the other members of camp, I couldn't tolerate my symptoms any longer. As the campers began reciting kinos, I had no choice but to retire from the synagogue in an attempt to find comfort in my bunk. After changing into sweatpants and turning on the air conditioning, I pulled out an empty notebook and began to write. I began to lament both temples' destructions that Tisha B'Av commemorates and my own pain. It came from a solemn place within me, a place at once familiar and deeply foreign. Instead of reading the kinos from past millennia, I was writing my own. As I filled each page with poetry of my symptoms, of their erosion of me, my awareness grew greater. My time for a diagnosis drew nearer. With my head pounding, I closed the notebook and stood up and walked to the camp doctor. After hearing my symptoms, the camp doctor said it was likely a respiratory ailment, probably nothing to worry about, but he told me to see my general physician after camp. A month later, I got my diagnosis, cancer. And I found myself with the rest of my family on the 9th floor of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, waiting to see the pediatric oncologist who would treat my non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I was 21. My treatment lasted a year, taking me through the entire cycle of Jewish holidays. It consisted of 9 aggressive rounds of chemotherapy plus a month of radiation to my chest and neck in 3 cycles. Entering my first round of treatment, I weighed 165 pounds. After the second month of chemotherapy, receiving treatment Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. till 4 a.m., followed by 2 weeks off to be monitored, hydrated, and transfused with blood or platelets, I was down to 115. Incapable of keeping meals down due to nausea, I went a month and a half eating only yogurt and frozen grapes, which forced my nutritionist to supply me with liquid food intravenously from a bag hooked up to my port. Mucositis, a side effect of chemotherapy, filled my mouth with sores so painful I couldn't speak. I wrote anything I needed to relay in a notebook, and my sister would act as a messenger. Even what should have provided comfort, laying my head on a soft pillow, became torture because of the pain. There is tired, and there is tired to the bone. Chemotherapy saps all of your energy. While I underwent treatment, it depleted my own will. I spent those first 2 months as an inpatient. When Sukkot arrived, after celebrating in the Sloan Kettering Sukkah, I was sent home in a wheelchair. I had been in bed for 2 months. My legs were weak. The highlight of Simchas Torah, the joyous culmination of Sukkot, is Hakafos. Dancing around the shul, hugging the Torah scroll, and singing songs of fortune. This seemed to me an insurmountable task. Physically weak, mentally exhausted, and having lost my hair to the chemotherapy, I didn't even consider going to shul at first. Then one of my best friends asked me if I'd like to go to Hakafos. My family was spending the holiday with friends, and there was only one place I wanted to go to hug the Torah. Eish Kodesh, Rav Moshe Weinberger's shul. I met with the Rav in his office a few days before Simchas Torah and discussed my situation. I left his office feeling elated and for a moment forgot all about my illness. His shul was my destination on Simchas Torah. My friend rolled me there in my wheelchair nearly 2 miles. As they passed me the Torah, I hugged it with all the strength I had and began to dance with the community. My fortune was vast and I was so happy. I thought that maybe my bald head shone like the face of Moses when he came down from Sinai. The worst side effect of all being a 21-year-old forced to move back into his parents' place was the recurring loneliness. The first night of Hanukkah, a Friday night, I had the house to myself. I lit candles before sundown in the window pane of my room. As I stared into the first candle, I thought about the Jewish custom of lighting the shamash, along with the number of candles for each night of Hanukkah. Because we cannot take benefits from the Hanukkah light themselves, we light an extra service candle, just in case we utilize any of the light emanating from the menorah. I thought then of a different reason for this tradition. We light the shamash so that on that first night, the single Hanukkah candle flickering will not feel alone. That is where I was emotionally by Hanukkah 2009. With friends graduating from school, some finding jobs, others getting married, my life was not only completely on hold, but it flickered weakly. It could be extinguished at any moment. Purim came early in 2010, or at least that's how it felt to me. For weeks before the holiday, I kept petitioning nurses from Sloan Kettering to allow me to drink wine. Of course, I wasn't serious. My immune system was compromised, my liver was beaten from the chemical poisons. Drinking even a glass of wine was never an option. I went to a meal with my friends who were all drinking and sat them on my first sober Purim. I thought of the lyric from Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, "Businessmen, they drink my wine." For an entire year, I was basically idle, like a Seinfeld character, a show about nothing, living each day in sweatpants like George Costanza. I was completely worn out from the treatment. My will depleted. I began having follow-up scans to measure the effects of the treatment. First once a month, then every 3 months. I had a PET scan, a CT scan of my chest, neck, abdomen, and pelvis. The tests came back clear. Of any trace of tumor, I was in remission. After a year of treatment, I could begin planning the next step in my life, but I faced a new hurdle. Motion. I had the opportunity to start rebuilding, but no energy to actualize it. To not have to go into a full day of chemotherapy was all I wanted at this point. I couldn't muster the energy to be productive beyond that. Free from the hospital, I would need another entire year of recuperation before I was strong enough to re-enroll in classes, move out of my parents' apartment, and re-emerge in an attempt to regain myself. I learned in that time that coping in and of itself is forward motion, even if it's just thoughtful, mindful introspection. By Tisha B'Av 2011, 2 full years after my initial diagnosis, I felt nearly back to full strength. I went on a trip to Scotland. Spending Tisha B'Av in Edinburgh stood in stark contrast to my Tisha B'Av 2 summers earlier. Having forgotten to pack non-leather shoes, I walked back from shul in my socks after hearing Eicha. It was a little more than an hour walk, but I was more comfortable on Tisha B'Av, hiking old cobblestone streets without shoes, than I had been that Tisha B'Av I spent in camp. Today, at age 24, I have been in remission for 2 years. I'm entering the last semester of undergraduate studies and preparing for another Tisha B'Av. Marking the destruction of the temples, we often consider the holiday to commemorate the end of our culture's peak. According to Jewish tradition, however, Tisha B'Av is also the day when Mashiach is born. Within our suffering and beneath the ruins, there is a flask of pure oil waiting for us to retrieve it. Cancer made me feel completely misunderstood and out of place, but it also made me more self-aware. It gave me a new perspective on the world, helping me appreciate simple dialogues with loved ones and strangers. Above all, it was transformative and empowering, giving the knowledge that only an experience like this could impact, to know what it means to be empathetic. This is the story of my Tisha B'Av. The first word for cancer to appear in medical literature back in the time of Hippocrates around 400 BCE was carcinos, from the Greek word for crab. It's a linguistic coincidence, but it seems to me connected to the similar sounding word kinos, the elegies of Tisha B'Av. Since that hour on my bed at camp 3 summers ago, I have searched for the notebook where I wrote my own kinos and filled pages with my own pain, but I haven't found it. Maybe like the old Jewish custom to bury the books of kinos deep in the ground in the hopes of not needing to use them in the following year with the rebuilding of the temple. I buried them somewhere deep in my room. What I feared then as my life's end, like the temple's destruction, turned out to require me of the courage to begin again. One of my kinos did show up, the one that I'd torn out of that notebook. I found it last year on one of my best friend's fridges. And Chevra, this is the most meaningful kinos that I've ever read in my entire life. As the heart of the nation beats, the mind of the people settles to focus. Time has brought us to the place of redemption. The tears have dripped into a pool of blood, leaving behind a darkened moon. So the nation lifts its legs and rises above, perfecting what is theirs, and begins to walk alongside the rising sun. Day has broken. I think that's the most powerful thing I've ever read in my entire life. Day has broken. That's what it is for us. We're all cancer patients. We're all broken, we're all mourning, but within that mourning we're looking for each other, we're looking for the Ribbono Shel Olam. We're looking to return the Alufa Shel Olam into our lives, to go from Gola to Geula. May this year be the last year of Tisha B'Av, that next year, B'vias Goel Tzedek, when the Rebbe is standing here in Yerushalayim, maybe on this porch, and he says, Nach Tisha B'Av, he won't mean it the way he meant it all those years ago. It'll be Nach Tisha B'Av, the Tisha B'Av before destruction. Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuv v'chadei sh'meinu
v'kem. At this point, we're going to finish up Ma'ariv.